Hi, it's Amy Guth. Tonight, the Saturday night special is preempted by a certain sports broadcast on WGN. And hey, you know what? That's okay. They certainly bring in way more ad revenue than I do. But you know what? That doesn't mean there isn't still plenty to talk about. In particular, digital privacy is weighing on a lot of minds right now, especially on the heels of data breach news from Equifax and earlier, Yahoo. It might seem that the two industry giants are in very different categories. Credit reporting bureaus, after all, don't come with an opt-out. Our data is there, whether we like it or not, and Yahoo, Google, Facebook, Twitter, those types of companies are opt-in and only really know what we tell them, right? Well, not quite. The world's most valuable resource is in fact no longer oil. It is data. And here's the thing. It's not just a matter of identity theft anymore, though that is certainly something to take seriously. But what is at stake is potentially something far bigger and larger reaching. Imagine, based on what Google knows about you or thinks it knows about you, that it serves up higher prices because it thinks that you can afford it. Or lower paying job listings because it believes somehow that you do not fit the profile of a leader. Or suppose it serves up ads for no credit check required types of services again and again, reinforcing a sense of unworthiness or otherness, a subtle cue that you are not to be trusted as much as some others. How can we not internalize that? And this might sound far-fetched, but let me tell you, it is not. What's at stake is not just a matter of not letting a stranger apply for a credit card in our names. No, what is at stake is the unchecked power of tech companies to influence our feelings, sway our purchases, limit access to the jobs we apply for or even see, and reinforce both seats of power and who they're able to prevent from having access to them. There's a lot here. So this week, esteemed producer Tom Hush and I worked during the week to prepare a show for you anyway. We spoke with two authors, BJ Mendelsohn, author of The End of Privacy, and with Jacob Silverman, author of Terms of Service, about this topic and what the narrative is missing and what we can demand from lawmakers, from tech giants, and from ourselves. I found these conversations compelling, and I hope that you will too. Hear them both next, right here on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. We're talking all about privacy tonight. And I'm not talking about windows and window shades. I'm talking about data privacy, digital privacy, our digital lives, and all that means, because a lot of times we get down that road and we it's easy to feel a little overwhelmed by it. And sometimes it's a little bit difficult to sort information, misinformation, paranoia, you know, all of those things. So we have gathered experts tonight, and we're joined now by phone with we have Jacob Silverman with us, who is the author of Terms of Service and an expert in this topic all about privacy. So thanks for being with us, Jacob.
Thank you.
So to start, can you talk us through a little bit about the book, what prompted you to write it, and sort of the main themes that you tackle in this book?
Well, I really wanted to take a critical look at the big tech companies, and particularly social media, and see how these services were affecting our lives, how they're affecting privacy beyond just traditional notions of privacy about what we know about each other. But I was very concerned about what do big companies know about us and how do they use that information to try to advertise to us, of course, but also to influence us in subtle ways.
Well, which is a pretty big topic, especially when we think about
how that played into the conversation and conversations we're having now about the election and about politics and about influence, particularly in Facebook. We talk about Facebook and how, you know, there's a lot of conversation around was there influence from on the election based on how we curate our feeds or even from outside foreign influences. So that topic comes up a lot. And so what would you say are the hottest and you know, most emotional and touchy points since you wrote the book, since it came out in 2015 to now?
Well, I think big data breaches are something that have really increased in the last couple of years. And it contributes, I think, to a feeling of helplessness among some people when they see that Equifax is a good recent example, but it could be Yahoo having all of its accounts exposed, or a number of big hotels, medical care providers, all kinds of institutions have had huge amounts of data spilled onto the internet in one form or another. So I think that's something that we've definitely seen the rise of in the last couple of years. And I think also people are just wising up in a sense, and they're learning that maybe they don't have much control over their personal data, but they're at least understanding that, okay, somehow I am the product here. These companies are making money off of me and my identity and my behavior. And hopefully that gets people to realize, well, maybe I can demand some things in return, or consumers should have certain protections.
Right. And we've seen a little bit of that. I feel like Europe is a little bit further down that conversation's road than we are here in the U.S. It seems like privacy has been maybe not taken more seriously, but addressed in a very different way in the European market.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you have more opportunities for people to file lawsuits on behalf of consumers, as there's an Austrian lawyer named Max Grems who's been fighting a lawsuit in European courts for years, trying to get Facebook to turn over more information, to be more transparent about its data collection practices. So Europe is definitely way ahead of us. And unfortunately, I don't think that under the Trump administration, you're likely to see any sort of consumer-friendly laws or regulations passed about the data trade. You might. I mean, the Equifax breach seems to have attracted some bipartisan anger. But still, I'm sort of doubtful that any measures taken will benefit consumers very much.
Right. So when we look at that transparency that we hope for Facebook and other tech giants to have, what do data companies really, really know about us? You know, there's that expression that if you don't know what the product is, you are the product, of course. But what, you know, I think it's so easy for that to downward spiral and for us to get really concerned about it. And we should be. But when we really stop and say, okay, what does Facebook know? What does Twitter know? Is there a lot more out there that we're not considering, or is it really just a matter of, well, a company can't know anything about me if I don't share it?
Oh, no, that's definitely not the case. And certainly it would be understandable if people think, well, I don't post much on the internet, or maybe I belong to Facebook, but I never use it. But that doesn't really matter. Certainly if you post more information and post more often, these companies have a much better opportunity to get to know you. But they're already collecting information on you. A company like Facebook is tracking people all over the internet through the like buttons that are on various websites, on millions of websites around the internet. Those act as little beacons that send information back to Facebook about who's browsing there. And then you have things like the data trade, which is really about a $150 billion business, and companies, big companies like Equifax or Axiom. And they're doing deals with Google and Facebook and other big tech companies. And then you could also bring up the matter of the permissions you give to apps, which often are able to access your GPS, so they know where you're going, they know where you're shopping, things like that. So there are really many ways in which these companies get to know who we are, what we do, where we go, where we shop, what we believe, who we talk to. So I wouldn't really fault anyone for not knowing about this stuff or thinking that they have some defenses or control over it.
And so what are the stakes? You know, I think when we traditionally think about privacy, we immediately think of it in a traditional sense, right? Of someone looking in our windows, looking at our lives without us giving consent to do so. there is an upside in that we do get a bit more targeted advertising. We do, you know, people aren't going to try to market an ad, you know, a product to you that if you say like diapers, if you don't have kids, and it knows that you don't have kids. But there are some upsides. But how high are the stakes of the data that we know when we talk about being location data, things like that? You know, what is the risk attached to that? I know that sounds like a simple question, because I think our knee jerk reaction is because we don't want people to know about us. But I want to dig a little bit deeper than that. And why is it? What is really at risk for that being known by tech companies?
Sure, I think that's an important question. First, I would say we often start from this position to say, well, what do you have to hide, or what's the harm? I would also say that I think these companies owe something to us to justify their practices, and I think we should probably start from that position. But also, I think this kind of data collection and the data trade without any meaningful transparency or regulation is just going to get more invasive and more pervasive in terms of where it's happening and what kind of information is being collected. Already we know that Facebook, for example, is glad to work with any advertisers, including people from extremist organizations, to A/B test ads and try to reach their audience. There's been some good reporting on this lately. And we know that also companies like Facebook study how to essentially manipulate people and get them to click on things. So I think the real concern is the sense of manipulation, the sense of loss of control. And we don't really know what kinds of studies and experiments are being done in us, but we know that the web is just a series of what are called A/B tests being done on us all day long. The founder of OkCupid, Christian Ruder, wrote a book a couple of years ago where he basically admitted as much. And this is really empowering for these kinds of companies to have all this data about us, to understand our habits really well. But it's far less empowering for us, I think, as consumers and as people who might care about our privacy. So in the end, I think we have to be careful for this kind of corporate manipulation of our moods and feelings to try to get us to buy things or click on things. But also I would say that these companies owe it to us to justify these kinds of practices.
Yeah, that sounds completely reasonable. And in your book, Terms of Service, you talk quite a bit about this very kind of this sense of hunger for power among tech giants, of really that, you know, just what you're really just describing. But would more transparency really equalize that for consumers? Would it be a little more of a balanced transaction if consumers had transparency, or is there more that we need?
Oh, I certainly would like to see more, but I think some form of transparency would be a good step. I've seen some commentators call for more transparency around political ads, for example, so that we know who's paying for them on Facebook and where they're coming from and perhaps why we're targeted with them, which is similar to what happens when we watch TV and we hear that a political ad is paid for by a particular campaign. There's still a long way to go. I mean, these companies are basically massive surveillance machines. We take some of this for granted, but Google, for example, has taken photographs of the whole world practically. So it's a new kind of power that I think we're dealing with, a new kind of relationship. Some of these companies, like Equifax, have origins that go back decades, but this is really new, where these companies can follow us around all the time and really know so much about us and really survey our whole lives. And I think it's going to take a while to really reckon with that kind of power and figure out how to deal with it and how to fight it if need be.
Yeah, well, how do we fight that? I mean, I love the term massive surveillance machines. I really, really like that, because that really is an important perspective shift when we think about what we're really talking about here. With, yes, Facebook is fun. We can keep up with our nieces and nephews and our friends from high school and know what events our friends are inviting us to, and we can participate in conversations on Twitter around the world, indeed. But when you look at it with those through that lens and with those stakes, it suddenly is something you must take more seriously. So how do we even begin to demand that kind of transparency, particularly if we open that to extend that to things like Equifax? We have no choice but to participate. There's no opt-out there, right? We credit bureaus are watching us whether we want them to or not, and jobs and homes and so much of our lives is sort of predicated on being in good standing with them. So it is I think, an off-putting and a bit overwhelming imbalance of power. So how would we even begin to demand that kind of transparency?
There are, I mean, certain measures you could call for. It depends on how radical you want to be. I mean, I think encouraging the tech industry through one way or another to adopt different business models that don't depend on personal data would be great. I saw a couple calls to nationalize some of the credit bureaus after the Equifax breach, which I certainly wouldn't oppose. I mean, there are ways in which credit bureaus, as you said very well, have come to dominate Americans' lives. And if that information is incorrect, we often don't even have any sort of remedy to change our credit file. We could also call for the SEC or the FTC to have the power, or perhaps some other governmental organization, to have the power to audit the algorithms that are used by these companies. So we know for example, Google doesn't have to expose their search algorithm to the public, but a government entity could have the right to come in with some technologists and computer scientists, perhaps, and audit that algorithm to make sure that it's serving the best interest of the public, that there's fairness here, and that really these companies are delivering what they promised. But it's really hard. I think we're still in the early stages of trying to figure out what to even ask for here.
And so for now, as you know, we are in these early stages, and it is easy to feel very powerless to the tech giants. So how could one opt out now from where we are, or at least maybe not opt completely out, but opt somewhat out, or behave in a smart way online? What are the things we need to be doing or thinking about as we're using these services, or services that we have no choice in, like credit bureaus?
It's very difficult. Under the Trump administration, the FCC allowed ISPs to start selling more personal data. So even if, for example, you use something like a Tor browser, which helps anonymize your traffic, the underlying internet service provider may still be able to sell all kinds of information about what you're doing. I would encourage people to still look at various privacy-enhancing tools like ad blockers and other things that block ad trackers. A lot of this surveillance that I criticize really comes in the form of advertising or what's called ad tech. You can also look into using Tor and other anonymizing services. But really, nothing's going to change without some sort of collective action, without lobbying your representatives and encouraging them to, for example, hold hearings into the practices of data brokers, which has happened, but we haven't seen much positive change from these kinds of hearings and investigations. So I think start lobbying your representative when you're making calls about saving Obamacare or some other issue.
Are there organizations that are doing this work in a meaningful way that people could learn more from or get attached to if they were interested in pursuing this, in a deeper way or through activism or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the ACLU does a lot of good work. The Electronic Frontier Foundation. There are other groups like Privacy Matters or Privacy International, a lot of groups with sort of privacy in their names, that are doing this work of studying these issues very closely and lobbying government officials and kind of the difficult work of finding sympathetic ears within the government bureaucracy to talk about these kinds of things. So a lot of those organizations also have useful tutorials about online privacy and what you can and can't do, and on a day-to-day basis, whether you want to be using privacy-enhancing applications and things like that. Oh, and one other thing I would add is, yeah, whenever possible, try to use encrypted chat apps like Signal. WhatsApp is generally considered pretty good as well, even though it's owned by Facebook. That's something you can do very easily in the everyday just to communicate safely with other people.
Right, definitely. There are a bunch of those kind of apps that a lot of people seem really drawn to. And so when we talk about this topic in particular, because you have such expertise in this area and you study it so closely, what are the main narrative as people talk about this day to day, even thoughtful conversations, what are the things that just really stick out to you as kind of missing from the main narrative or perhaps really widespread misconceptions beyond what we've already discussed?
I think one thing that people need to realize is that all this kind of data collection that we're talking about, it doesn't just feed in more personalized ads. It also feeds into things like threat assessments by police or the kinds of job listings you're able to see online and search results and sort of all kinds of automated systems that may dictate your way in the world. I mean, for example, and I think we also need to be conscious of how bias comes up in these systems. So one good example is there was a study a few years ago by a computer scientist who discovered that names that are traditionally considered African-American when plugged into search engines would produce results for things like, and this includes advertisements for things like background checks or bail bondsmen. Now, these are clearly the product of some kind of discriminatory thinking or some kind of racial bias, but often these systems are so complicated that people don't even know how that kind of bias is introduced. So it's important to understand that these systems are very complicated and that different forms of bias or what's called digital redlining can appear in all kinds of ways. So we're not just talking about a sense of your privacy being invaded to show you very specific ads. We have to understand that offline forms of discrimination can often be reproduced in digital systems and online.
So that is a fascinating area because we often think about this being this can't have anything to do with bias because this is all automated. But that is, I mean, that just really stands out to me as so significant when you're talking about the things being targeted to different users. That's very fascinating, particularly when we, to me, that's a very short leap to a conversation about the importance of diversity in tech workplaces. When we talk about very homogenous work cultures, it's to me very hard to be fully clear or prevent work around bias and to fully have conversations around bias and to see your own blind spots and much less to fully understand the full experiences of all your users. So to me, that's a very, very fascinating area. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that area in particular, where originally where a human being has to there are touch points for human beings when we're talking about, what search results are going to return and things like that for different users.
Sure. I think another perhaps related example is with some facial recognition technologies that have been deployed in photo apps have misidentified people of color, especially those who are dark-skinned, as animals sometimes. And, of course, it's been deeply offensive to the people that have experienced that. But it's just another example of lack of diversity in tech and how these systems are often designed. They're designed with a certain default in mind, which often means generally white males. And when these systems are designed for people of a certain background or experience, you don't have the opportunity, one, to let other people try those systems to make sure they don't produce these kinds of discriminatory or offensive outcomes. And also, it limits who these things are for, and it clearly shows a kind of naivety, I think, and a type of inexperience on behalf of the tech industry.
Certainly. And when you're talking about the search results part, that to me, that is, if different groups are getting different type of search results. That one, that example in particular is really sticking out to me because to me that is reinforcing social structures and power structures in such
Absolutely.
A significant way. And that's.
Yeah. One other example is there have been similar studies that found that women are sometimes showed lower paying jobs, which of course only exacerbates the income disparity between men and women that already exist. So I think it's so important that people realize that these kinds of offline inequalities or things that we're used to thinking of as legacy, perhaps of some earlier less progressive era, are definitely being reproduced or reaffirmed in one way or another online. You could just imagine also how these kinds of things could carry over to real estate listings. Another example is the use of something called variable or differential pricing. Increasingly, people are being charged different amounts for things online depending on what their data profile says about them, and depending on how much an algorithm thinks they're willing to pay.
I've heard that one before, particularly around air travel, that you should, you know, clear your cookies and then go search again or open a different browser. And to me, the way that is discussed has always been a little disconcerting because it's done so casually, which immediately makes me wonder, let's back up and say, how did we even get here? Did novelty and kind of the ability to connect with people in a different and unusual way, is that what got us this far? Because it seems a boiling frog kind of situation, that if we were dropped into it today and we were fully aware from the jump of this is what is at stake and this is how much we will perhaps suffer as a result of this information we're trading, we will get different search results, we will get shown lower paying jobs, we will get social structures and power structures reinforced even when they are against us. If we knew all that, it seems like it would be a very hard sell. So when we start at the very beginning with social media and data trade and all of that, what led us down this road relatively quickly?
Well, I think the fact that all this stuff is free, that most of these services are free, is very appealing. And network effects are powerful. When a lot of people you know join a website or a social network, it's tempting to want to be there too. So I think people can't necessarily be blamed. And people have often also had a very lackadaisical attitude towards privacy, or it was even considered somehow more progressive or to just be relaxed about your personal privacy and not care what other people think about you, to live more openly, to share more. That has almost become an ethic in and of itself. But I would also say that we also just have to learn how to talk to each other about what these costs are. Another way of looking at it might be, for example, if I were to follow you around and write down everything you said and everywhere you went, you would probably be pretty concerned about that, especially if I said, well, I'm going to give this to some big Facebook corporation. But we're not really used to thinking that way, that this is essentially what our devices are doing. They're tracking everything we're doing almost 24/7.
You have given us a lot to think about. The book is called Terms of Service. It is by Jacob Silverman. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jacob. Really appreciate your very thoughtful approach to this very complicated topic.
Amy Guth here. Thanks for listening to the Saturday Night Special tonight. Before, during, and after shows, I often tweet out links to many of the stories and topics and guests that I mention on the air or talk with on the air, so feel free to connect with me on social media. Username Amy Guth, G-U-T-H, on all platforms, Twitter, Facebook, and possibly my favorite, Instagram. Though, mostly I just post pictures of flowers there and soup. And sometimes selfies. Don't judge. Anyway, thanks for listening.
WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. We're talking now with author BJ Mendelsohn. He wrote one book called Social Media is Bull, and he's written another one called The End of Privacy. And tonight, as we're talking about privacy in our digital world and all the things that that conjures up, I could not miss a conversation with him. So please welcome to the program BJ Mendelsohn.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, I'm thrilled that you're taking the time to talk with us today about this really important topic. So a lot of times when we talk about privacy, we're just kind of automatically wired to just say, oh, privacy is good. We need privacy, and it must be bad if we don't have it. But sometimes we don't really take the time to drill into what it is we're talking about and what things we are keeping private and things like that when we're on this subject. So kind of talk us through that and tell us a bit about your latest book.
Yeah, I think the big takeaway from the new book is that there's no privacy. Not since 1917 during the First World War. We may think we have privacy, but even people who are, like, let's say they're in the middle of a cabin in the woods in Montana or something, Experian or TransUnion or even Facebook probably has a data file on them and is selling that information to turn a profit. So you might think that your stuff is safe or that you've never been a victim of a hack, but you have been. And so that's really the big takeaway, is that this is something that now affects all of us. And to think that we're safe somehow, it's just not, that's just not how the world actually is today.
Well, and you bring up a really interesting point about, you know, the odds are your data has been compromised at some point. We think about our data being compromised as immediately that's going to trigger a series of people taking out a mortgage in our names and doing all these things and identity fraud and it being really huge and impactful. But a lot of times that takes much smaller forms we don't even realize, or nothing necessarily will happen to us just because our data is exposed. So kind of talk us through that a bit, because I think that part is one area we tend to gloss over and panic about just because of what's possible, but often don't look at what, you know, what probably happens most often.
Sure. I think the big thing, and I talk about this in The End of Privacy, is that you don't, your experience online, like if you're wondering how does this even affect me, your experience online is completely tailored to the data these companies have and are selling about you. So you might think, all right, well, how does that, you know, how, why do I suffer from that? First, you're not getting any of the billions and millions of dollars that your data is generating for these companies. So I'm a big believer you should be getting a cut of that money, and we're kind of being ripped off. But the second and more important thing is that we're really missing out on, like, the full promise of the internet, right? I thought back in, I'm a child in the 90s, so I remember people calling it, like, the information superhighway. It was going to bring you all these amazing things, but now everything is so custom-tailored that you just don't really get outside your bubble. And because of that, you're not getting exposed to ideas, you're not getting exposed to different opportunities that might come your way. And more frighteningly, the data out there can be used against you in ways that you may never realize. For example, you might go to a bank and apply for, you know, let's say a loan or something, and they're going to go online and look at the data they purchased from all these different companies and deny to you, and they don't have to tell you. Like, there's nothing on the books right now that says, hey, an algorithm said, based on your data, that we're going to deny you a loan. Like, they could just arbitrarily do it. And then if you look at things like teachers and test scores, I mean, there's a lot of instances where the data that's processed is completely arbitrary, and it's just pulled down from a bunch of different sources and the computer spread out, all from the information that's out there on the web. So even though you don't think it impacts you, every time you create more information, it creates an opportunity for that information to be used against you, even if it's a very minor, subtle way, or if it's a major way.
And often I think we tend to think about this as, well, I won't share anything that personal. And I know I've given that advice to people before of just, you know, well, you don't have to share. You don't have to overshare. You don't have to say, you know, decide what's private for you. But there is a different side to that. There is a much deeper and perhaps a bit sinister side to that when it's, because it's really no longer just a matter of choosing not to share, say, your spouse's name or your kids' names or your address or your salary. It's much deeper.
So a lot of people don't realize this, but if you go and you're looking for an apartment and you find, like, this great apartment in Chicago, your landlord or the company that owns the building can look at all the data that's out there on you and render a decision based on that and never tell you. Like, there is no obligation for them to be like, oh, yeah, well, you know, we were denying you this apartment because of the data we've collected. So, like, that's the most immediate thing. There's other instances where you could be denied insurance. Your insurance premiums might go up if you have a condition that the company learned about in collecting and gathering information about you. It's a little frightening. These things happen all the time. And, you know, the most annoying one probably that you've encountered and people have no idea is that Amazon adjusts price based on your browser activity and the items that you've been looking at. So there's instances where you might look at an item and it's more expensive than it might be if your friend is looking at the same item. And this stuff happens all the time and there's no protection for it.
That is very irritating. I think we hear about that happening a lot with airlines. You know, there's always that advice on travel sites to, you know, clear your browser history and then go look at ticket prices because perhaps they might change. But irritating that perhaps is applying to the toilet paper and paper towels that we're buying on Amazon and those kind of things too. So, but it does beg the question. You know, we I think there's kind of two camps here, because we look at the recent data breach with Equifax, which is I think part of the frustration with that is that's something we don't we can't opt in or out of. That's there whether we want it or not, collecting our data. As opposed to things like Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, all these big tech giants that are, I mean, technically optional, although it's very difficult to navigate without them.
Well, I would argue that they're not optional at all. There's a legal term that I hear floating around. It's contract by adhesion, which basically means, you know, you don't have any option to not use this, like, this platform. So, for example, if I don't sign the terms of service, which absolutely no one reads, I can't use Facebook. So it's a completely one-sided agreement between you and a lot of the tech companies. And then the scary thing is that they can go, and they often do, go and adjust the terms of service to say things like, hey, we own all of your stuff that you've uploaded, which has happened more than a few occasions between, like, Instagram and Dropbox. So the good news is that there are some laws on the books that should protect us. The Fair Credit Reporting Act does allow us to look at our credit report once a year. So for things like Equifax, you can at least correct the information that's gathered. The thing is, you can't do that when the information has been gathered by Amazon and pretty much every other company on Earth. Over in the European Union, starting May 18th, they're going to have the capability of opting out and still being able to use a platform like Facebook or Tinder without having to worry about all this information being collected, because they'll have the right to actually say, hey, I want you to delete that, or hey, you can't have that information for more than 30 days. So I'm kind of like in the middle of that argument, where I'm kind of like, I don't mind if these companies are going to gather and sell my data, but I want to be paid for it at least. You know, there's absolutely no reason why Facebook or Google or Amazon can't cut me a check, even if it's something small that represents the profit they made by gathering and selling my information. And I would be okay with that, especially if it was a big check.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, in the United States, we don't yet have laws on the books, except for maybe Washington State, where it's kind of like, hey, this is what governs the kind of data being collected, and this is what we can do about it. And the thing I advocate for is that, because I have no confidence in the federal government to do anything, I'm a big believer that people are listening to this and they're angry and irritated. They should contact their state representatives and ask for state-level laws to help dictate what these companies can and can't do with the information.
Well, it seems like this is another example of where the law hasn't caught up with behavior. We talk about this a lot with, you know, bad behavior online, abusive behavior that's really hard to enforce in some instances. So... Excuse me, but we talk about this a lot, I think, in the digital frontier, because it's a bit like the Wild West until the laws catch up with it. And it's always just like a step ahead. But what's interesting to me is how seriously privacy has been taken in Europe as opposed to here. What do you think the difference is culturally that's manifested so much legal action in Europe as opposed to here?
Well, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, and I say this because I don't often levy criticism to the Obama administration, but the company that visited the White House the most was Google during his 8 years in office. And Google, and when I say them, I mean Facebook and Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, has spent millions of dollars in lobbying to make sure that there's no laws that come out and actually have any teeth to it in terms of protecting the data. So over in the European Union, it's more like those corporations have less power than they would here in the United States. And so that's sort of the downside. Like, there was a number of instances under both Bush and Obama where they could have came in and said, hey, we're the Department of Justice, and you can't be doing this with people's data. And aside from slapping Facebook on the wrist gently a couple of times, we just really haven't done anything. So, I mean, that's the key difference, is that we don't have the functioning federal bureaucracy to protect us in the way that the European Union does, and especially now where I can't even tell you how the federal government operates. There's no infrastructure there in place to actually take action and say, look, you guys can't do this, which is why I'm kind of like, if you call your state representative, even if your state fails to do something, just the threat, if enough of these states and enough of these attorneys general come after the tech companies, they will start regulating themselves better. I mean, we saw that with Microsoft, where Microsoft ultimately settled with the DOJ, and they said, all right, look, we're going to make changes. This is clearly something we need to correct. So I'm confident we can get to the same place as the European Union is, but we can't count on the same levers in place that they have over here because of the lobbying and the access to the politicians that these tech companies have.
I want to switch a little bit to focus this conversation next on social issues, particularly around bias, around a rather homogenous workforce in the tech giants, because that is something that comes up a lot, particularly around workplace behavior. But I wonder about your thoughts on how that manifests with privacy issues and with things that you're describing here, like not getting a loan, like getting turned down for an apartment, getting prices changed, getting opportunities displayed differently.
Yeah, the consensus seems to be that the algorithms and tools that are in place, thanks to Google, Amazon, and company, they are great for the rich, and if you're poor, you're out of luck. And the most common example that we hear about that is if you're calling customer service and you're a high-profile customer, the data is going to say, hey, someone needs to actually talk to this person. Whereas if you're poor and you're not valuable to the company, they're going to send you to some automated system, and good luck getting your problem resolved. So there's unfortunately a lot of that going on where we're using these algorithms to kind of segment people. And then we create these situations where it's sort of like the broken windows theory or stop and frisk, where the data says, hey, if you go in these areas and check people, they're likely to be carrying weapons or committing crimes, even though the data 9 times out of 10 has proven to be wrong. And yet we kind of worship the numbers that are given to us by these companies, and we don't stop and go, hey, did you ever wonder if maybe stop and frisk doesn't work? Like, that took a really long time for people to have that conversation because they just worshiped at the altar of the data. And so the challenge we face as a society in terms of the impact that these algorithms have on different groups is that we don't stop and ask why. We just look at the what. So if the what says you're poor, then the company isn't going to talk to you. Like, they're not going to stop and go, hey, maybe you just missed a credit card payment a couple of times. You know, there doesn't seem to be any critical thought, and that has led to just a lot of bad news around the way. I mean, you look at stuff like PredPol and crime statistics, and it's like, yeah, sure, that area might be showing up as bad, but why is it bad? Like, what can we do to actually take action and fix it? Putting more police there just makes the crime over a little bit. So it's just sort of ridiculous when you think about it, but that's, you know, nobody has this conversation, and that's sort of the struggle that's happening, where we're just not talking to each other and saying, hey, what does this data actually mean, and how do we interpret it? And so we're just saying, the data says this, let's go.
Right, right. And I see that I hear that your dog has a strong opinion about privacy, too.
she definitely does.
That's okay. Animals are entitled to their opinions, too. So what was the catalyst for beginning this project and doing this research? Was it a smooth transition or an obvious next step from your first book? Or did something happen that made you really become interested in this topic?
No, I think when I was doing the research for Social Media is BS, I was just kind of like, look, these Facebook ads, 9 times out of 10, 8 times out of 10, if we're being generous, don't really work. And yet we've got billions of dollars going into this, and we've got all the media companies back then, anyway, praising Facebook as if it was like the savior for media. And that's just the kind of thing where it was like, all right, well, what's fueling this? Let's just put aside whether or not the ads work or not. Like, why is Facebook so valuable in the first place? Why is Google so valuable in the first place? Why are these companies that for a long time really struggled to make money valued way more than something like an ExxonMobil? And it all came down to data. And then as we started looking to them, I was like, well, I didn't know they were doing that. Did you? Who were they selling this stuff to? But you mean that they have a complete data profile on me as an individual? I thought all that stuff was supposed to be anonymous. Because that's the thing you're constantly hearing, right? Like, oh, you know, we test data onto each other and it's completely anonymous. And it's not true. Like, you are not anonymous on the internet. Even if you're using something like Tor or if you're using a messaging app like Signal, there's still ways to collect data on you. And there's still ways to put an individual file together on you and all your habits, all your likes. And they're making money off of this. And so that's where I was kind of like, hey, well, okay, pay me. Like, if you're turning billions of dollars and you're selling people garbage because these ads are not effective, then I might as well make some of the money. And so that that sort of just led me into this. And then I started digging into the algorithms, and then I, I was reading about how it's really benefiting the rich, and if you're poor, like you're really going to be punished going into the future with the way that we look at the data and we don't actually stop and interpret it. So that just, I guess, injustice kind of angered me to the point where it's like, I need to say something, because it's not that people aren't saying anything, it's just that we're not having this conversation in a productive way.
Right. It seems like we often, well, I think it the research that you've done for your book, it seems like it's very difficult information for the layperson to access. We all kind of have hunches, but it's in fact very difficult to, there's no customer service phone number for most of the tech giants, right? You file a ticket and you wait and you're at their mercy. So because there is so much secrecy and so little transparency, it's very difficult to confirm hunches and to get that information or to for them to even confirm or deny what our suspicions are. And there's very little reason for them to do so or care about what we think, right? There's such a, particularly Facebook, like what a large user base. I think the latest said 1 in 7 people on the entire planet is using Facebook every day. So,
they claim.
I mean, yeah.
So the thing is that we all think it's magic, right? Like when you hear the word algorithm, people's eyes tend to glaze over, but it's just a cooking recipe, basically. Like it's no different than what you would use at home to make pot cookies, except maybe you're listening to Rush as you're doing it. So like we don't stop and go, hey, why do these things actually mean? Like, what does it mean to be an active user on Facebook? Because Facebook ain't telling you what that means. They have never defined what it means to be an active daily user on Facebook. It says you interact with objects. Okay, well, I logged in with Spotify on my Facebook account. Does that mean I'm an active Facebook user? So it's not in their best interest to tell us anything. And for so long, I hate to blame the media for anything, but one of the biggest faults probably in the early 21st century is looking at these tech companies and treating them like they're magic and saying, wow, look at how this thing grew overnight. I mean, Facebook's a great example where in the run-up to Facebook's explosive growth, everyone was like, it's viral, it's wonderful, it's amazing, but what no one talked about was that Facebook was buying companies that were notorious scrapers, which just means they were going out grabbing people's email addresses and all sorts of personal data and then spamming those people to grow their site. But we just didn't talk about that. We just talked about, the power of social media. We had all the Gary Vaynerchuks of the world come out and tell us that you can do it and you can crush it and hustle by using Twitter and make yourself a big millionaire. So that's sort of the issue, is that we just haven't said, all right, everything just needs to stop. And we have to look at this stuff and say, what does it mean when you say algorithm? Oh, well, an algorithm is just a cooking recipe. Cool. Now I understand what this is, instead of just saying, oh, well, the algorithm is magic and wonderful and powerful.
Or intentionally allowing it to be shrouded in mystery and assuming it's something only, right. Only a select few could understand. So how did we get to this point? How did we get here? I think anytime we say the media, I think it's essential we acknowledge the very large role that is played by social media users.
Sure.
No longer, every day I feel like this is the hill I'm going to die on, but every single day I see these conversations happening on social media, particularly Twitter, saying, oh, the media said this. I'm like, well, actually a bunch of Twitter pundits did that aren't affiliated with any news organizations.
Right.
So be accurate, be clear with what we're saying. So I think it's really essential we acknowledge the role of social media pontification and how, making declarative statements or that's sort of the way of the internet. Snark is the default setting and language of the internet. I think that's important to acknowledge too. But at some level, we have gotten to this point. At no point did we all join forces and say, absolutely not. Until you have more transparency, oh tech giant, we're not going to let you proceed. We're not going to do this. So is it novelty that propelled us to this point? And it's like the boiling frog conversation that we slowly but surely this is kind of neat and cool and let us keep in touch with people. And over time we realize, wait, we're being cooked here. Or was it something else?
Well, so it's a giant convergence of events. And I detail this in Social Media's BS, but kind of the short version is that I don't think it's nostalgia or it's hyperbole or anything. Like I kind of look at it as like we've had 20 years And since 1994, we have consistently treated every tech company as if it was magic and wonderful. And for us to be like, oh, well, to treat Facebook the same way, even though we've seen other social networks coming on like MySpace, I mean, do you remember, when was the last time anyone had a conversation about MySpace? I think is where we messed up. We kind of dropped the ball, because to do it for like 5 years during a recession where you had a lot of like former real estate brokers that were becoming social media gurus, and there was a lot of tech companies and media companies that were really struggling, especially on the media side, where it's like, all right, well, nobody's buying advertising. Maybe social media is the thing that's going to save us. You know, I understand that aspect of praising and being excited about social media, but to not look at the whole continuum going back to 1994 and saying, hey, wait a second, every single company that's come along, we've treated as magic, including Netscape. I mean, Netscape, we treated like it was this big and wonderful thing, but it was just a ripoff of another browser that was developed in Illinois called Mosaic. But yet, when it came out to the press, it's like, wow, look at this amazing thing. And that's no different than how we treated Snapchat just recently. I mean, like, I feel bad for anybody that's invested money in Snapchat, because Snapchat not once ever stopped and said, this is how many users we have. In fact, they're being sued for actively inflating the number of users that they told people they had. So I don't think it's the novelty of it. I think it's just a failure to stop and go, you mean to tell me since 1994, all of these companies are magic? Really? Every single one of them?
Well, and we even use language around it that really does speak to, you know, we call the tech giants that reach a certain value, we call them unicorns. We call, you know, we use words like magic. We use words like algorithm and, you know, that sounds like alchemy. And we use these words that tend to shroud it in mystery. But as you also pointed out a little bit earlier, I think it's very interesting that the language around online success, rather than speaking to long established tenets of business and dominance and power structures, we often use language like crush it, kill it, you know, very like quite
right.
Brutal language, really, that's supposed to be kind of fun and cheeky, but in fact is really technically very aggressive language, which I've always thought was very, very interesting.
Yeah, and a little off-putting, too. I mean, when you think about it, because I think that stems more from, like, the bro culture.
Yeah.
With a lot of tech companies where this is the language that's used, it's not terribly inclusive, and then it's obviously most of these companies in 2017 still fail most diversity tests. And so I think it's more a reflection of just the kind of companies and people running them and not looking at the way the world actually is.
Right, and which is a topic I address all the time on this program, certainly. You know, there are so many issues, and even just talking about privacy and how search results deliver different or search inquiries deliver different results to different users. At some point, we think about this being so automated, but in fact, at some point, that is. Those choices are created by a human being, and we really don't have a way to hold those human beings accountable. We, you know, I talk about this a lot when we talk about behavior online, particularly around Twitter. I find it very difficult to believe that a very homogenous work culture, workplace, could possibly understand the plight of all of its user base, which is quite diverse, when it itself is not diverse hardly at all.
Right. I mean, if you look at Twitter, they're just now rolling out more stringent anti-abuse policies. It's 2017. Like, it should not have taken you this long to go and do that, especially because Twitter's been around for 10 years now and there's been abuse. I mean, look, I've been on Twitter since almost day one, and it's been just as bad as it was now. It's just now, you know, people are talking about it and saying, hey, you really need to do something. So the fact that it takes these companies so long to actually take action and correct these problems is troubling. And, you know, the problems that we don't have the DOJ or the FTC or really anybody, it doesn't matter who the administration is, we just don't have anyone at the wheel saying, hey, you guys need to be better about this. I mean, if you look at AT&T back in the 80s or Standard Oil or any big monopoly, anytime something huge came around that was bad for people or had policies that were bad for people, the government stepped in and said, you need to correct that. But that's just been out the window since the second Bush guy's office.
And is that just because of a sense of this is a topic for people in the technology field that can't possibly be comprehended by those in the political field? I find it hard to believe. Yeah. I mean, I find it both hard to believe and not hard to believe at all that somebody somewhere in politics couldn't comprehend it. You know, but like on some level, okay, maybe it is incomprehensible, but that certainly is something we need to shift.
And here's a good example. There was going to be a children's toy that was going to come out this year from Mattel called Aristotle, I think it was. And two senators were like, whoa, wait a second. This toy is a live recording, and it's got a server, and you know, someone on the other end is receiving all this data that's going on from your kid's bedroom. And they wrote a letter, and they said, we want to know more, and there was going to be, you know, there was a threat of an investigation. This just happened like a month or two ago. That was a children's toy maker. But where was that? You know, where were those guys? It was a Republican and a senator, a Republican and a Democratic senators that got involved. So it was a bipartisan thing. Where was that action at any point with these tech companies? So I don't think that they don't understand it. I think that they've allowed the tech people to run around and go, oh, well, you know, if you regulate us, then you're anti-innovation, which is not true at all. Like, if you look at what happened with Microsoft, when we finally stepped in with the DOJ and said, you know, Internet Explorer is everywhere, this is not okay, there was an explosion in browsers. That's when you saw Chrome. That's when you saw Firefox really take off in popularity. That's when you saw all these other ones come about. So to say that regulation doesn't breed innovation and therefore you shouldn't touch us, it's insane. Like, it's BS, honestly. Like, there's no better way I can put it. It's just straight BS.
Yeah. And so where do we go from this point where we do have an unbelievable amount of power seated at the helm of tech giants? And you know, I think there's a whole other conversation we could have just about the social justice impact of that, because of the aforementioned issue that those seats of power tend to be rather homogenous. So that's a whole other conversation for another day, though. But what do we do now? Because there is a feeling of some degree of powerlessness, because as you pointed out, you can't really opt out, and there's some you can't opt out of at all, like credit bureaus. So what does the consumer do right now to try to have some sense of privacy, or at least be mindful and be on top of where that data is being collected, or start to change the tide?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that privacy is kind of dead at the moment. That doesn't mean it can't come back. I want to be clear, because sometimes when I tell people privacy is dead, they're like, well, what do you mean? It is temporarily dead. It can be brought back, but it has to happen on the state level, because the federal government, just especially under Doofus in chief right now, nothing is getting done. So if you're listening to this and you're like, hey, I would like to get my privacy back, then the thing to do is call the state attorney general's office in your state, or to talk to your local state representatives and say, I need laws on the book on the state level that says you're going to protect my data. You're going to copy what they have over in the European Union with the GDPR law, which is what allows people to have their information erased. And by the way, that law has strict fines, too. So if there's a security breach like what happened with Equifax, in the European Union, if that happened, they would have to pay out billions of dollars in fines. And that's what we need. It sounds easy on paper. I know it's easy to get set up, too, with the way the government is, but it can be fixed. But it just takes people listening to this and people reading the book and people talking to each other to say, if I call my state attorney general office and if I call my state representatives, we can at least create the threat of action. And the threat of action itself should force Google and Amazon and Facebook to start making changes. And if we can get them to start making changes, we can have a larger conversation. So I know it's frustrating, but that's, we can fix it. We just have to have the will to do it.
Right, which does seem hard to muster in the current political climate, when there's always something new popping up to exhaust us. As you have undertaken this topic and developed expertise in it and done all of this work and all this research, how has it changed the way that you connect with people over social media and the way that you use digital tools in your life?
I've done the complete opposite. So I am now giving out, like, my phone number to whenever I do an interview. It's Is it okay if I do it here?
Sure.
So people listening to this, if they want a free PDF of social media is BS, they can text me. This is my real number, by the way. So 646-413-3840. All you have to do is text me the word sheetrock, and I will send you the book. And so I tell you that because I've just embraced that I don't have any privacy anymore. Like in my book, I'm in the end of privacy book and in social media BS, I am completely open about everything as a way to demonstrate that right now there is no protection. So you have two choices. You can go in either extreme. You can go try to live in a cabin in the woods in Montana, or you could do what I'm doing where I'm saying, I've got no privacy anymore, so I'm just going to tell you everything there is to know to highlight this is the situation we all live in. So that's what I've done. I don't encourage that for other people because I'm now constantly stopping people like, hey, how's your health? I saw that you were dealing with depression recently, so I get into those conversations with complete strangers. But I do that to highlight that this is the world that we now live in, and if you don't want to live in that world, then there's things that we can do.
So you are taking the hiding in plain sight approach, and
yes.
I think that's interesting, and that's I've thought about that many times myself. I do wonder, though, particularly around online culture right now, if that would be equally feasible for all citizens.
I don't know. I'm a pretty big social justice believer, so I struggle with, all right, well, I'm a straight-ish white guy, so it's easy for me to kind of walk around and be like, hey, I'm going to tell you my business, but that might be really hard for different groups of the population. So I don't know if that's something that would work for everybody. I don't recommend it, but I think it's a discussion worth having, and then if it interests you, try it, because right now you have no privacy anyway. Like, it is very easy. I can't stress this enough. Like, you might think that, like, if you come up with a clever screen name or something, that you're hidden, right? You're, like, it's your secret. But all it takes is one little mistake, and there's a data trail, and we can find out everything there is to know about you. And in some cases, if you were born within the past 10 years, we know everything about you from exactly when you were born, thanks to Facebook. So, like I said, it's definitely a discussion to have. I don't have a good answer for that. I just know that, with the position that I'm in, I'm able to do that. I don't know if it necessarily translates as much as I would like it to make that point, but it's definitely something we need to look into.
Yeah, I mean, it's one I've thought of, too, because as we face issues like doxing and real threats online, especially towards women, those threats tend to be very sexually violent in nature. And I wonder about that. And I have thought about the idea of hiding in plain sight. But I've also thought, on one hand, perhaps I could hide in plain sight. On the other, perhaps I would be, it really only takes one person to do real harm to somebody. So I think it is an interesting topic that you raise, though, for sure.
Yeah, it's like that. It's I think that's part of an all larger ongoing discussion we as a culture and society need to have with each other. And it does deal with privilege. It does deal with power. And I am not an expert in those topics for sure. But at the very least, I can at least be some kind of example to demonstrate that we don't have any privacy at the moment and why we should bring it back.
All very interesting and thought-provoking stuff. BJ Mendelsohn, thanks so much for being with us today. The first book is called Social Media is Bullshit. The second one is called The End of Privacy. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Hey, it's Amy Guth. You hear me talk about esteemed producer Tom Hush all the time, but did you also know that he hosts a podcast on WGN Plus? It is called No Coast, and it's all about film and the film business from Chicago to Hollywood. It's smart, it's interesting, it's self-aware, and it is pretty darn funny. I hope you will think so too. Again, that's No Coast Podcast on WGN Plus, hosted by esteemed producer Tom Hush.